Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. How are you doing, gentlemen?
Shalom.
Shalom lecha.
I'm well. How are you, Charlie? Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, Charlie.
I appreciate your cordial attitude.
That's nice. He never gets welcome to the podcast, Tim. He always welcomes us. That was very thoughtful of you.
I was just being kind.
Aw. Mm. Tim's being kind.
Every once in a while.
If you could invite any Tolkien character to be a podcast guest, who would be your first character you'd invite?
Gandalf.
Gandalf?
Yeah, that fits. I would go with Gandalf.
And if it's not Gandalf, then it'd be Frodo. And then it'd be...
No.
Oh, really?
Tom Bombadil. I would invite Tom Bombadil. It would be glorious. Speaking of Tom Bombadil.
Elrond.
Oh, Elrond would be good. I still think Faramir would be a good one, too. That's what I was going to say after I said Frodo. You guys both shut me down. What? Really, Faramir?
Well, the elves live so long. They have so much wisdom, you know? Come on.
They'd all be a pretty good interview, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, so speaking of...
Oh, sorry. Can I go back? My third choice? Yeah. Barley Butterman.
Oh.
The guy who runs the Inn of the Prancing Pony. Oh, yeah.
The pony.
Bill the pony. That'd be a quick one. Put me right out of the horse's mouth.
All right. Horrendous. Move on.
Well, speaking of Bill the Pony, this is another talk episode. And so...
Charlie, that's my favorite when you do that. It's on my mental... I'm riding my mental bike. And then you take a stick and you put it right in the front tire and I just go...
A non-sequitur. So yeah, we, as Thinklings, are going to answer you, the listeners... questions. And we have those queued up in a document here. But before we do that, I do have some announcements. Sponsors, we're still drinking some Happy Place coffee from Just Because.
From Just Because in Georgia. So Just Because, if you're listening, I kind of doubt you are. But if you are a man, we love your coffee up here. So thanks for making good coffee. Georgia. Thanks, man. Thanks for sending it.
Why do we love the coffee?
Because it tastes great. It's bright and bouncy, Charlie.
Incorrect answer.
Oh, why?
I don't know.
Just because.
Oh, brother.
Okay, and then our normies, Brick House, Porch Light, and Blue Cow, the friendliest herd around.
And listener, if you want to sponsor an episode, send us a quality bag of coffee, and we will drink it, and we'll give you a shout out. We've been really enjoying this.
We absolutely will.
Impromptu thing that happened, but I like it.
Yes. And then announcement, we are trying to get 200 reviews by our 200th episode, and those reviews are in Apple Podcasts. So if you have not left a 5-star review with a comment in Apple Podcasts, you can do that and you'll be entered to win bookstore, things, gift cards, books, clothing, things like that. And when we get to 200 reviews, we will pull from those 200 reviews for the winners. And if you've already left a review, you're like, oh man, I can't leave another review. You can. You can steal your grandma's iPhone and leave a review from her account.
All right.
Books or you can business. Tell her about it.
You know, I have not even left a review or a rating on our own podcast.
Well, you know.
I'm saving it.
I think I did.
No.
Anyway.
Books and business.
All right. Let's do some books and business. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first because I'm going to get pretty heavy pretty quick. So I'm writing. I'm actually just trying to get married and it is like crazy busy. I'm teaching modules. It's like,
should we let this guy in?
Let him
in. Staring in the
let
door.
Him in. He's a friend of the podcast. He's a friend of the podcast. I'll get to my thing in a moment.
He's going to teach
the man, the myth, the legend, Dr. Brown. Say
Santa Claus.
Greetings.
Santa Claus. He's always Santa.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question, and you just have to give me, this is a yes or no question. You don't get to make any caveats, okay?
All right.
Wow.
Is Psalm 2 a messianic psalm?
Absolutely.
Lean closer.
Ooh. Okay, great.
Absolutely.
Love it.
Man, that was like authoritative too.
We were talking about that. We were in Hebrews 1 in the last episode. And talking about Psalm 110, but then sometimes there's psalms that aren't, they're more symbolically applied than a full messianic psalm. So
what if there was another professor named, like, say something like Fan Frown, and he didn't think it was messianic? What would you say?
I've actually done a lot of work on the Messianic Psalms. I did a workshop at Refresh on the Messianic Psalms.
He's wrong.
And it's a very, very rich, rich study, but it's also very, there's interesting poles of perspectives on it.
Okay. You're saying you wouldn't agree with Fan Frown's assessment, if that was what his assessment was. Just a random person. Well, someone whose name sounds like Fan Frown. Not related to you.
Well,
he's not
also not connected
at all.
To frowning at all.
He's totally in the dark, guys. I don't think he gets it.
Yes.
He just mouthed the words. Go ahead.
Not to say, so I was recollecting a conversation in a previous class between yourself and a few other gentlemen where we the students got to observe your conversation where it seems like we weren't all agreeing on whether some psalms were messianic or not. And so they may be symbolic, they may be, you know, the topology discussion came up, and so that's what they're referring to.
I'm okay with it being messianic. I like some too messianic.
Well, that's good, because so does pretty much all the New Testament writers, including Jesus.
Love it. What class are you teaching over there?
Really, we're close. Doing Colossians and Philemon. We just finished reading all of it in Greek, and now we're gonna reread it all right now.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So good to see you guys.
Good to see you too.
Have a good day.
What were we doing before this?
Books, Tim should just business. Call Books and Business again. We should start over.
I've said it like four times.
Oh, I was going to go first.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
So I'm really busy. I'm teaching 2 weeks of 8-hour-a-day modules. I am like less than 2.5 weeks out from getting married. So I am not reading a lot. I am trying to write. I'm having some interesting experiences I think are worth writing about. So I'll share one, and it'll probably go pretty heavy pretty quick. So last week, I'm at home prepping for podcast recording. And you know how like your house will make a creaking noise or a clicking noise of random noises? So down the hall, there's this click noise. And I kid you not, it sounded, the thing that immediately popped in my mind, because it sounded identical to it, was when Robin would get up and crutch down the hallway, and her crutches would make these clicking noises. It was a weird moment. Now, I'm excited about getting married. I'm thankful for how God's working in my life. But I'm still sad about my, and so it was a really weird moment. I didn't fall apart or anything, but here's what I would say. It was almost like it pulled me back for a moment, and I was right back there during the chemo days and when all that's going on. And so those things are starting to happen a little more frequently. We were cleaning out stuff in the basement, and a pile of pictures that used to be in some frames that we used for Robin's funeral right there. It's like a wedding picture and this picture and that picture. And I was like, oh, look, I flipped through them, and then, oh, I'm back. So I think what's going on is that's like taking up a lot of RAM space in my mind in the background. It's weird. I don't know how to describe it, but I'm not saying it's the same. Did you experience something like that when you lost your dad? Because like today I was like walking over here or driving over here thinking life is kind of back to normal. I'm kind of doing the things I always did. Hey, she's gone. And it's this weird.
Yeah.
It's this weird feeling. I'm not, listener, I'm not saying I want to go back. I'm not saying that. But it's like I'm living my life almost just like before, but she's not here. And I'm not wanting that. But and so I'm trying to like figure out how to process that. So I'm trying to write some things. So.
Well,
but have you had that where like it's, you're like being pulled back all the time?
It's a really interesting thing because part of it is that they are gone, but we personally experience it because it's a part of us that's gone. And like the people aren't just, you know, outside or our friends and family, they're a part of who we are. They bring out parts of us. They have formed parts of us. And so when they are physically gone, I think there is a reality of where they, as a part of who we are, is gone. And so you're like in this sense of remembering, and absolutely mm-hmm. that happens with my dad. And, you know, the first year was kind of the wild one where I'm pretty sure like something like that was happening almost daily. But then as you go on and on, it's like weird things that kind of bring up, like, you know, you drive a certain place or yeah. you hear a yep. certain thing. And
I was previewing a movie. I'm not going to say which, because I'm not trying to cause anyone to be offended or stumble, that I thought, and maybe I'll watch the kids. And
what's it about?
Not going to say any detail because I don't want anyone to try to guess. But there is a scene where this person is in a hospital bed dying, bald. Clearly they've got some sort of cancer. And there's like family. There's even like a kid. And I'm okay. But man, it brought me really close. And then later in the movie, there's like a flashback to that scene. And I just broke down and wept. And it's so that what you were just saying is, I think as you grieve and you process, like Robin and I grieved together for like a year. And then I think my recovery was different on this side. But I think with school being done and all these other heavy responsibilities coming, and there's yeah. like things in life that always happened with her.
Yeah.
It's like they're coming back, and it's making it it's okay. I just thought this is stuff no one sees, and it's in me. And I thought, well, this might be, if there's listeners out there who've gone through this and you're like trying to get back into your life, and it seems like it's.
Can I ask you a question?
Like a big, I'm wearing a weight vest. Go ahead.
So this is something I experienced with my dad. Do you ever feel like it's disrespectful to ignore it?
It's like, oh, I just got to shove that off and move on.
Like, oh yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. Just forget. And you're like, no, like you can't, like, you know, that's for me. It's like, this is your dad. You can't ignore this. But then at some point you're like, well, this is kind of, you know, do I need to focus all my attention here? And then you almost have like a guilt of shame, not feeling yeah. the way you used to about
yep.
it.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and for me, it's in two directions here. Cause I'm super excited about getting married. Like Melissa is yeah. phenomenal. And then like these come up and it's like, what do you do with that? Now, theologically, I know the truth. She's in heaven. She's with the Lord. Yeah. She's looking down so happy. If she is, if that even happens, I don't know what they know. If they know something, she's fine with this. But it's been weird, and I think it's because I'm going through things at times of the year when I would normally go through them with her, and it's just taken up a lot of it's almost like I've got like some sort of anchor and I'm trying to do everything in life, but it's like I'm going slower. I don't know. It's weird. But I just thought, okay, books and business, that's the business I'm going through. So
I think writing on that is
because I think probably, so it's been interesting. So on total side note, there's another widower or widow who I sort of know distantly, and she's also going to get remarried or whatever, but she's often posting also about how she's still like grieving the loss of her former spouse. So it's interesting the way this whole thing works. It's very interesting. And I just thought I would say this because if you know someone who's going through this, there's probably internal stuff happening that they're just not, hey, this happened today, and hey, this happened today, and hey, this happened today, you know, kind of a thing. So,
well, and we don't, you know, we can move on too, but I also felt at the time as someone who did a lot of speaking.
Oh yeah.
That I mm-hmm. almost got to a point where I felt like maybe I shouldn't talk about this, but when you're preparing a sermon or you're, you know, in discipleship and something of that tragedy yeah. happens, you can't just compartmentalize those things out of your life. Mm-hmm. And in a very real practical sense, that was the trial God used in my life for about 6 to 8 months.
Yeah. Yep.
And mm-hmm. so that does become a filter by which you then are sharing with other people, but then you get to a point where you're like, well, maybe they don't want to hear about this anymore.
Yeah.
And you know, if, putting it in the heart of the listener, like if you have someone in your life who you're like, man, I wish they wouldn't talk about that anymore, just realize that they maybe think that too, yeah. but they won't. And maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't. You know, it's not a moral statement, but it's interesting to talk about. I think you should write on those things.
Yeah. And last thing I'll say is, listener, just remember everyone processes these things differently. I know a number of people close to the situation and everyone's having, it's so interesting. People sort of distant, people closer, people really close. And the just, I don't think anyone's processing it the same. So,
yep.
So that's my books and business. That's a bit of a heavier burden, but hey.
Excited to read that.
I got to get it written. I got it started, mm-hmm. but.
So my books and business is going to be very different.
I'm so excited about this.
Backtrack here. We've mentioned Carolyn Weber. We are looking forward to recording with her. Had some snags there. She had some family things as well take place. And in the midst of that, we've kind of transferred some emails back and forth. And I asked her, you know, if someone wanted to start dabbling into the romantic poets, where should someone start? And her answer was, among other titles, the first one was Lyrical Ballads by Wordsworth and Coleridge. And so I purchased that. I've got the beautiful Penguin Classics paperback of it. And the first poem or ballad here is The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And what's going on in the story is there's, I'm not exactly sure who the characters are, but there's someone going to a wedding, and then they meet this, to use Dr. Boyd's term, a very briny individual, you know, a sailor, you know, and he's like, come sail with me, you know? And so they jump in the boat. And so this first ballad, I just loved the end of it, but I was also kind of curious as to what's going on. I'm also going to caveat this that I have not read any further yet. So I'm just reading. Here's a snippet of romantic poetry, romantic in the sense of its era, not its content. A snippet of romantic poetry that I thought was fun and I enjoyed. So they're on this boat, and then in the midst of the changing seasons of the ice and all this winter, there's a bird that comes that kind of, in my understanding at this point, signaled like a change of weather, spring is coming. So here's their reception of this bird. At length did cross an albatross, through the fog it came, and it were a Christian soul, we hailed it in God's name. So this bird is from God, the seasons are changing. The mariners gave it biscuit worms, and round it flew. The ice did split with the thunder fit. The helmsman steered us through. The ice is melting. And a good south wind sprung up behind. The albatross did follow. And every day for food or play came to the mariner's hollow. In mist or cloud, on mast or shroud, it perched for vespers nine. So I think a vesper is like a certain day of the week, maybe, or... So like 9 weeks it's with them. I don't know that for sure. So it perched for vespers nine, whilst all the night through fog smoke white glimmered the white moonshine. And then here's the last line of the first of the seven things here. And this is where the twist comes into the story. God save thee, ancient mariner, from the fiends that plague thee thus. Why look'st thou so? With my crossbow I shot the albatross. So here's the bird sent from God.
Meat's back on the menu, boys.
Dude, listener Charlie just completely turned away from
it. Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah. So, and then I don't know yet why he shot the. Was it a. I think. It's like he shouldn't have killed the bird. So I think like that's going to come up again. Like he did a bad thing and they're going to pay for it. That's what Boyd kind of primed my pump for. But I don't know if, you know, I haven't read farther yet. But yeah, enjoying the romantic poets. Thank you, Carolyn Weber, for the recommendation.
I think vespers, I looked them up, are evening prayers. So it could be like 9 days.
9 days. Okay,
yeah, that cool. Might be.
So a few weeks ago, I talked about Davies' commentary on Exodus 1-18, and how this is just volume 1, chapters 1-10.
Was such a good listen. We were rolling.
So I got started on it, and it had some good observations. It's a very technical commentary with a lot of details I don't even care about. For example, he spent 60 pages, I think, discussing the different texts of Exodus that we have, both Hebrew, well, not both, Hebrew, Greek, Latin, blah, blah, blah. Not just like, hey, the Hebrew text, there's like, no, there's this manuscript and that manuscript and this manuscript and that manuscript, and talking about how well they're preserved or not preserved. But overall, he gets into a lot of the JEDP theory stuff. So segmenting out, this is from this source and this is from that source. I always hate it when they do that because it's so speculative and not helpful. So there's a couple of things that are, I don't know, maybe a little more cons. They're not as helpful, but it is a technical commentary and has helped me on a couple of cases, particularly in Exodus chapter 4 with Zipporah. So he had some helpful comments there. And then even there's a textual issue in Exodus chapter 1 that he helped me on. So Davies, Exodus 1 through 18. I'm not sure where this is going to rank in my lineup on Exodus commentaries, but it's definitely my most technical commentary on Exodus.
So I think I know what you meant, but you said there's so many details in there, like even I don't care about these, like some of these, yeah. Like, even I don't care about, and I know what you mean, like you're an expert, you have to read all this, and like even you don't care about them.
Mm-hmm. What?
But on the podcast, the one who cares the least about the most things is you, so I was like, you might want to change your expression. That was pretty good, Tim. Come on, you got to give me that one.
Horrendous.
Okay.
Charlie doesn't know what to say.
I'll give it a 4.1 out of 5.
Oh, that's good. I'll take it.
Out of 5.
Okay, out of 5. I'll take it. I thought it was out of 10 at first.
Let's talk talk some. Yeah, talc. Let's talk about some questions.
We're finally getting to the questions.
Yeah. Dr. Brown just popping in for fun. That's a good. If we could have that happen on every talk episode, that'd be wonderful.
Oh, I know.
And anyway, so this is talk 3, and we've got 5 questions queued up here. And I'm going to kick us off. And just to remind my if with 3 of us, are we all co-hosts or are we tri-hosts?
Well, we're all co-laborers, so that's co-works.
Co-hosts.
Tri-host sounds fun, though.
No, so it like, doesn't.
So.
What about the Triforce of Hosts?
Still.
Ooh. Anyway, just remember that this is color-coded. So I am yellow, Tim is green, and Andy is orange. If you haven't noticed yet, the name of the people who left the question is in a beautiful pink. And so Decker Werner sent this question to us. And I think Decker was in my Christian experience class. And he was also, I think, in Boyd's literature class. And so, anyway, a student of faith. And he said, I noticed that you guys have updated a lot of things on your website. Thank you, Decker. We do slowly try to update things. But not the goodness scale. So he's, why even updated the goodness scale? We still only have seasons 1 and 2 and the Christmas and summer reads. Here's the question. Are you going to update it soon? Well, to that I say, is Christ going to come back soon? Oh, I would say maybe soon isn't the best terminology, but I would say the update is imminent. It could happen at any time. There's nothing else holding the update from happening. And so, you know, nobody knows the day or the hour.
This just went to like the Lutheran satire place where we're teaching theology like through jokes. Werner, Decker, you just learned about the definition of imminency.
Yeah. So to seriously answer your question, yes, we are hoping, I am hoping this summer to blast back through some seasons to get those ranked. Obviously, all 3 of us have, various and sundry responsibilities with school and work and life. And so we always have the best of intentions with our website. And then we, you know, update them as we can. But yes, we are planning to do that imminently.
Mm-hmm. And our social media manager, who is also helping with that, just had a baby. So she's very busy, too. So we're all really busy.
Baby Kirkwood is greater than the goodness scale.
That's right.
He's a 10 on the Thinkling
Scale. That's right.
He's
a 10.
And anyway.
Have you ever looked up the definition of sundry?
No.
It means various.
Hmm.
So various and sundry is various and various.
What does sultry mean?
No, no, we're not going there. It's too spicy. That's what it means.
Various and salty responsibilities.
No, no.
Various and spicy responsibilities.
Tim, number two. Go to number two. Quick,
now,
Tim.
In every church I have ever attended, we observe the Lord's Supper by each receiving our individual little styrofoam wafer. We do not literally break bread. Why do we take one word literally but not the other? Have we compromised out of convenience or a fear of germs? Are we perhaps missing something in the symbolism of the ordinance by not literally breaking bread? It seems in 1 Corinthians 11 that the congregation was lacking in unity, and that unity was a theme of the Lord's Supper in that passage. Would physically breaking bread with one another in the church better promote the unity we have through Christ's death? I'm interested to hear what the Thinklings thought are on this ordinance. And this is by Tiffany Zajac. I'm not sure how to say her last name. But you had some thoughts on this. You said,
I do have some thoughts.
So I'm going to let you just go.
So this week I taught Baptist faith or Baptist history and belief. It's a class on Baptist history for the first half and then Baptist theology on the second half. And one of the things that we do talk about when we get to the ordinances is the age-old question that's posed by, I think it's Dr. Dan who posed this question, could you use Mountain Dew and Doritos instead of grape juice and bread? And then do you have to use unleavened bread and real wine? So I'll give you my quick answers, and then you guys will probably want to weigh in on this. Tim, I would answer this question differently now since your episode on alcohol, and I'll get to that in a moment. So when we answered that question, the same question came up, does it need to be one piece of bread and we're all breaking it off? So he says, this is my body broken for you. Take it and eat. So I think Jesus has already broken the bread and then he starts to hand it out. Either he does all the breaking or he breaks the main thing, then he passes it around. But I think probably you've got to ask, what's the symbol referring to mostly? Now, this is my opinion, and it's fine if I'm wrong. His body was broken, like for the penalty and the punishment of sin, and he was perfect. Why did they use unleavened bread? Now, the Passover meal uses unleavened bread because of the speed they had to leave, right?
Well, I mean, but there's a symbolism.
Yeah,
to
exactly.
That one.
What's the symbol?
Well, the symbolism is leaven represents sin.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, if there's leaven in the bread, then it represents that the bread is sinful.
Yep.
And, well, the bread is Jesus' body, and that's not sinful.
So I think since it was the Passover bread and it was leaven-free, and Jesus has on multiple occasions said, avoid the leaven of the Pharisees because he's referring to this sin, I think the main symbolism there is the perfect body, like the perfect life, and then the breaking of it. So I don't think I need to do the breaking. I just think it's the symbol is like, this is bread that was whole. Now it's broken. It's perfect, and it's on my behalf.
So the essentials are the body,
mm-hmm.
The bread is the body,
mm-hmm.
And the bread is unleavened,
mm-hmm.
Because it's sinless, yep. Representing Jesus' broken body.
Mm-hmm.
The incidentals are whether or not who's breaking it, yep. Or if it's already pre-broken, yep. Or whatever else.
I've seen churches where you go to the front and you rip your own piece right off. Where they hand it out in the tray, the styrofoam. I can tell you why we don't break the styrofoam ones. Have you ever tried to break a piece of styrofoam? It goes everywhere. Like styrofoam goes everywhere. So the styrofoam bread would do the same thing. Sorry, it was a joke, people. I'm sorry. All right, now let me talk about the blood or the red. Do you have to use wine? So Doug Wilson would say you have to use wine. And here's my argument in reverse. So how do you make grape juice, like what's the vehicle that takes grape juice and turns it into wine? What's that thing called? Starts with an F and ends with fermentation.
Fermentation.
Hey, what's leaven?
It's yeast.
It's fermentation.
Yeah.
So I actually think grape juice with a low or no alcohol content might actually better picture because it's like perfect.
Uh-huh.
So I would say it's okay to use grape juice. I don't think we need to use wine. And I don't think you have to break it, but it should be unleavened bread to represent it well. All right, what do you guys think? Because of that, I wouldn't use Doritos and Mountain Dew.
And so, and just to throw into the equation here, so we're pretty agreed upon unleavened bread,
mm-hmm.
as the ideal picture, no sin. But then, Tim, could you just walk quickly through the wine is the fruit of the vine?
Yeah. Yeah. So Jesus even says, he doesn't say wine, he says the fruit of the vine. And so the actual description of the fluid is that it should be a fruit of the vine. So what would be a fruit of the vine? It would be grape juice. It would be wine, alcoholic, non-alcoholic, more alcoholic, non as alcoholic, whatever. So the alcoholic content has nothing to do with their idea of wine.
Oh. So then why did they, it's not the alcohol content, but what is it? Why did they pick that? Why'd they pick grape juice?
So for me, what I articulated was it represents the blood.
And why did they pick
that? Best represents the blood would be grape juice, and which would be non-alcoholic, because mm-hmm. even in Isaiah 63, it's the grapes of wrath. Okay, which is why
John
are your
Steinbeck.
Yeah, why are your clothes all covered in blood? And it's the symbolism. The blood is the symbolism of the grapes, which is the threshing of the grapes at the threshing floor, which doesn't produce wine, it produces grape juice.
And the reason you picked this, sorry, this is what I was trying to get. Yeah. It looks just like it. It's red.
Looks just like
it. You don't pick orange juice. You don't pick white grape juice either.
Or Mountain Dew.
Yeah, you don't pick Mountain Dew. Exactly. I did say to the class, if it was, I don't know, say like some alien with, you know, if the alien had died for us that had yellow blood, then you could use Mountain Dew. But sorry, another joke, guys. Sorry,
I think it's to play out hypotheticals with more hypotheticals. So what if there was a plague tomorrow, and we no longer had grape anything? So we don't have wine and we don't have grape juice. Was the mandate in scripture that you only do it if you have these, or could you still practice it with slightly different elements? Now, there is obviously a difference of opinion on these things. If Doug Wilson was sitting here at the table, and you know, Doug, if you're listening to this, we love Dougs that come on our podcast. So you could be one of them. And we could have Doug Wilson and Dougie Fresh over here in the next room talk about communion. And
horrendous.
That's horrendous.
But so we understand that there's differences of opinion. Some would say, yes, you need wine, you need bread, but... Go ahead. Need bread.
Oh, that was good. I didn't even catch it.
Anyway, so, you know, could you still observe it if you had no fruit of the vine? And I think the point of the ordinance is that it is a memorial. Obviously, we would understand that not to be the ideal, but a church could still practice it and be honoring to the Lord with it if they were not able to acquire, you know. And so, for example, let's say they did have grape juice, but they don't have any way of getting unleavened bread, which I know it's hard to think of a scenario, but you can't observe the Lord's table anymore. You don't have that. Sorry. And that's not the intent. You know, the intent is not a prescribed, what's the word I'm looking for? Mode. It's a picture. Now that being said, we understand the picture and we understand the ideal of it. And there are positives and negatives to it. Now, I think it's a little different when you flip the ordinance. So, like, whereas I don't have a problem with bread, you know, with a little leaven in it, or grape juice versus wine, I think I'd be fine with any of the, you know, options there. If you were to do something different with baptism, I think that would be potentially more dangerous with the picture. So, anyway, just...
We talked about the same thing. So again, what is baptism picture? It's picturing death, burial, resurrection. Mm-hmm. And so when you do effusion instead of immersion, effusion is pouring, or you do aspersion, which is sprinkling, both of those break the image so much that it's not a picture anymore. Yeah. Whereas if you had bread and you had grape juice, or let's say you
red
had
Kool-Aid.
Red Kool-Aid. Yeah. I was going to say you're still doing or Mountain Dew Code Red. That's, I mean, we're getting edgy, but what if you're, you know, what if that's all you could get? Okay. I think you're,
well, I've
you're
heard
trying.
Of missionaries before where, cause we do talk about this in a very American context. I've heard of missionaries in other countries that they cannot get grape juice. And so they do it with Coca-Cola. And like that is what they use. Now, we all know that's not ideal.
Yeah.
And you'd have a better picture if you didn't do that. But I don't think that undoes the memorial of what the ordinance is intending.
So I'm then good. I'll address the second part of the question, and I think this is where it comes to the unity. It says, it seems that 1 Corinthians 11, that the congregation was lacking in unity, and that unity was the theme of the Lord's Supper in this passage. And I do think with when you look at the meal issues where some people are coming getting drunk and some people don't have food, like there is unity going on at these, whatever you want to call them, Lord's Supper, Love Feast, Communion Services, whatever. And then the question says, would physically breaking bread with one another in the church better promote the unity? I would say, I think because it's a memorial, the better way to promote unity is to remember the image better, not whether you break or not. I think you need to remember better that Christ died for you as much as he died for everyone else in that room. And so if you look at your enemy across the table, your opponent, and you think, I don't like them, and then at communion, you're all remembering Christ's sacrifice, you know Christ loves you, like enough to die for you. You need to remember that about your enemy. And so I think that probably the unity, the breaking, I'm not sure the act of physically breaking the bread would do any of that. I think it's, if it did, it's because you're better remembering what Christ did for you.
Yeah, and so have any of you, either of you two, ever had or partaken of a communion that was not the standard Baptist, where it's like we distribute the wafer, we eat together? Have you?
Twice. One time at one church I was at for a short time, they had big, and it was French bread loaves, and you'd walk up and you'd rip your own piece off, mm-hmm. and then you walk up and you get a cup of whatever. And then I was at a service where they had a bottle of wine and a French loaf on a stand over here in the front, and then they had a bottle of non-alcoholic wine for the kids over here. And I just didn't participate that time because I was not sure what to do with the alcohol.
Sure.
No.
Okay. So I've been a part of a litany of different communions where you go up and get it from the priest. It's alcoholic. It's not alcoholic. I've been in denominations where you go up and you kneel and like partitions of like 5 to 10 people and you get it. And then you go back to your seat. And then obviously our more standard where we all distribute and partake at the same time. So first, you know, are we to take the phrase breaking of bread so tersely that it is together we break it? Or is it, you know, like a euphemism for we're eating the bread, we're taking the bread together, which if you think about that for a second, if you're chomping it in your mouth, you are breaking it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think we get a couple, we should, depending on how communion gets administered, I'm speaking in my context, we always have a reminder that, you know, if you've got something that between you and a brother, you should make that right mm-hmm. before you partake. That's an aspect of unity, as well as we all wait to partake of it together. Mm-hmm. So we do eat the wafer, we break it all at the same time. And in our own hearts, we're being mindful together personally, but then remembering corporately, Jesus's body was broken. So we're all remembering it at the same time, breaking it together as we take the wafer. So I actually think we get that pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And then similarly with the cup. But I have been a part of services that use one loaf and we all get a piece from the same loaf. I do like that part of the picture, yeah. But I'm not willing to die on that. So
no, I agree. I like the one thing distributed. Yeah. I do like that. And I don't like the taste of the styrofoam wafers that we use, but you know, whatever. We good?
I'm good.
I feel like that was a pretty,
hey, good question, Tiffany. That spurred some good thoughts there. Thanks.
I mean, you sent that in, Tiffany, a while ago. So sorry, it took us a while to get back to you, but, yeah, thanks for that. So
no, it was only like 9 months ago.
Oh my word.
Yeah. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, right?
So
imminency. Imminency.
We'll answer your questions soon.
Soon. One birthed child later.
Horrendous.
Speak for yourself.
9 months? You know, okay, sorry. All right, number three. Charlie. All right, number three. I'm wondering your opinions on reading John Piper. If you recommend reading any of his works, which and what cautions would you keep in mind? And this is from the one and the only Biz Forrester, Elizabeth Forrester. Shout out to Elizabeth. Do you guys have thoughts? I can give my thoughts, but what do you think?
I really haven't read a lot of John Piper. I have met him. I've had a conversation Ooh. With him. He's a very nice gentleman. Obviously, he's within the last, you know, you can pick whatever time range you want. Like the Young Restless Reformed movement, he is probably one of the like Mount Rushmore famous American mm-hmm. theologians. And I do think there are some things to be cautious of with his church and the full breadth of their theology as far as the charismatic ideas there.
Yep. Yep.
But overall, you know, I think probably the only title that I distinctly remember is Let the Nations Rejoice, which is kind of an evangelism type of a book. And I didn't have any major issues with that. But I mean, you know, it's with every author. You want to be careful what you're being stirred for and how much you're being stirred for it. And so, but yeah, I wouldn't put a massive caution on John Piper, like don't touch him with a 10-foot pole, but maybe like a 3-foot pole.
That's, I like that.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good summary, actually. I'm appreciative of John Piper. I think he's helped a lot of people be more word-centered in their devotional life, in their spiritual journey, just getting people into the Bible. So he's done a lot of things online, like a screen share thing where he's like exegeting through a passage. Mm-hmm. So I'm appreciative of John Piper in a lot of those respects. As far as like his books are concerned, I actually haven't read many of them either. I read Let the Nations Be Glad like 15 years ago or whatever. And it's a really good book on missions. I actually appreciated it. He uses like an analogy of, you know, if you're fishing and you're being really, really successful, why would you ever leave? And he said, well, because God said to. And how you don't evaluate a ministry based upon just the results. And so if you're being successful and God's calling you to a field where you're not going to be very successful, and there's still a biblical premise to leave and to go. So that's a very unpopular message, especially in like an American pragmatic culture. And it resonated with me, and I still remember that point from that book. His other books, like Don't Waste Your Life. So that's, I've never read it, but the idea, the premise, I've appreciated. And then Desiring God is probably his biggest book, his most well-known book. Again, I haven't read it, but the ideas in it are solid. I think that they're good ideas. I need to read it. Actually, funny, this question comes up right now because I was thinking of picking up Desiring God and skimming through it in preparation just for some Ecclesiastes stuff. I'm teaching Ecclesiastes next spring, so I'm kind of getting into the Ecclesiastes world again. But what Piper says about enjoying life is very similar to what Ecclesiastes is communicating. God wants you to enjoy life, but you can't enjoy life most. You have to love him and desire him the most. So there's a lot of things about Piper that I like. Again, 3-foot pole illustration. It's a good illustration. Charismata, Young Restless Reformed. Those are some cautions.
John Piper put himself on the map with Desiring God. So that book, he takes his two historic mentors, like Jonathan Edwards and C.S. Lewis, and he drills down into motivations and desires. And I think what he's done is he has helped you to focus on like wanting the right things and not leaving yourself at this behavioristic Christianity. He's a very, in two senses, he's a charismatic preacher. He does believe in the charismatic gifts. Okay.
Yeah. Distinguish what you mean there.
But he is got personality and he's engaging mm-hmm. and he's like
right.
energetic and he has like yeah. charisma is what I mean. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people have really appreciated his speaking, his preaching. I really, if I had to say who's the Spurgeon of this generation, I think it might be him. Or if it's not him, it's either like John MacArthur. I think John MacArthur's another good choice. But I think Spurgeon was speaking to the lay people. That's like his name, main person he was aiming at. And sometimes MacArthur is, but I think he's up another level. But Piper's no slouch. So he puts himself on the map with Desiring God. the main time I encountered him was when I took a class in the New Perspective on Paul. He's engaged in that heavily. He's gone back and forth with a writer of the New Perspective named N.T. Wright. And his opposing Wright has been very helpful. He has a book called Future Justification. And then another book on Romans 9 or something like that, or 8 or 9. So he's done a lot of work in that area. He's been heavily involved in the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. He has a podcast called Ask Pastor John, where he does talk episodes, basically like what we're doing, or we're doing like what he did. So many have been super helpful. But like you said in the cautions, he spoke at the Passion Conference, like, I don't know, multiple times, and that's a big charismatic group. He is, when it comes to his eschatology, he's not a dispensationalist, but he's not quite a covenant theologian. He's kind of like in the middle, the squishy middle or something like that. And so I do think you'll at times have problems there.
His theology of the kingdom is off.
Yeah.
And that's where he sees the allowance for the miraculous gifts. So that's something you need to be on the lookout for.
He's always done biographical sermons every year of his ministry. And so that's something I've always really enjoyed. He'll pick one person and he'll read about him all year and do a biographical sermon. He has a whole conference in 2013 at his church on C.S. Lewis. There's good stuff. But when I was in seminary in 2005 or 6 or 7, one of those years, his church had so many Reformed people coming who had been baptized as an infant. And he's at Bethlehem Baptist Church. And it's all this Reformed crowd coming, and they want to become members, but they're baptized as infants, and they don't want to get rebaptized. And so Piper and his, whatever the board is, elder board or whatever, the crew.
Yeah, he has a church governance difference with us as well.
Which is odd because he's at a Baptist church. They all decide, hey, let's just allow the mode of baptism to be an option and let people sort that out in their own conscience. This is no big deal. Oh, that's a great idea. And they put that out that they were going to do that. And everyone lost their ever loving mind. And they were not prepared for the pushback, and it like got scrubbed and pulled immediately. And so I'm only saying that because he didn't think it was that big of a deal, but his own church flock was thinking, you can't just let people be infant baptized. Like, they were against it. And so he immediately, and the elders were like, oh, never mind. Never mind. We'll do immersion only. That's it. Now, if you're a pastor and you think that does say something about what you think about theological priorities and how much you're willing to give on the truth. So I would say that's what his book Think is really good. I love that book. So if I was going to recommend one book, it'd be Think. He takes pot shots at fundamentalists. That's the only thing. I didn't like the pot shots at fundamentalists, but it was a really good book.
Did he write the book Romantic Rationalist about C.S. Lewis?
And that was based on the 2013 conference. Yeah. Colin Duryea's and him and the guy who Joe Rigney.
Oh,
there's
a
whole bunch of them that were involved in that conference.
Yep. And that book is worth a read.
Yeah.
If you like Lewis.
Don't Waste Your Life, also a good one. Brothers, We Are Not Professionals. That's a really good one.
Yeah.
I like that one a lot. And then he got pushback from people who, and I think it's probably just the conscience issue. Like, some people, their conscience is so wound up that if they're supposed to desire God and then they don't 109% desire, right, they're like, oh no. And so he has a book called What Do I Do When I Don't Desire God? I haven't read it, but it looked like he was trying to bring balance to the force, which I thought was good. So I'd say 3 foot, 2 foot, 9 inches, 3 foot. Yeah, I'm down with that. I like that.
Yeah. I've heard him. Have you heard him live?
Yeah. I've listened. So when I was window cleaner, I listened through a pile of sermons.
To clarify, have you like been in his?
Oh no, not live. Sorry, nope, never seen him live. Never been there live.
So I've heard him speak live a couple of times, and I do think
he's a great speaker.
You can, if all you're doing is watching YouTube clips, you're getting a caricature. So I think you have to be in the room with him, and I think in that sense, I do think he's probably a pretty good pastor.
Yeah,
I think he's a very warm, kind person. Mm-hmm. I can disagree with people theologically and recognize that they're mm-hmm. probably nice people. I still don't know that, but that was what I got from him. So,
can I give just two more biographical elements? His older or oldest son, not Barnabas. Barnabas had some troubles, but what's his oldest son, has abandoned the faith and taken to TikTok and making totally diatribe videos against Christianity. And it was after John Piper retired. But I thought the way he handled it pretty well, but I do feel bad for him. So that's just something noteworthy. His son has turned away, and I think he's tried to be, he's tried to be as kind as he can, and but also not excuse his son. And then the second thing is, he grew up with a horrible stuttering problem, and he never thought he could go into ministry. And I, there's a really cool story. I don't remember all of it, where I think he was like, okay, God, I'll do whatever. And then God sort of worked in him to help him through his stuttering. And now he's this public speaker. And so he usually brings that up to say, you don't have to have the talent. Like, you have to have the willingness, and God will take care of you. And I do think that message is lacking today.
All right. So a moderate to medium score on John Piper. Question four, and this was from Tim Forrester, so a forest of questions here.
Ooh.
How does being,
that was so good.
How does being born Satan's seed affect how people live and how they see the truth or even desire to know the truth? And a handful of passages you sent with this, Tim. And so here's a couple of thoughts I'll put together there. And we're going to end the podcast today in 2 Corinthians 4, but certainly the adversary does want people to not see truth and to not live for truth. And I think we see in 2 Corinthians 4 his active ministry of doing that. He wants to keep people blind. And we see that in maybe in the way the world is structured, but I think we also just see that in our own depravity, that being cursed by sin, 1 Corinthians 2, we do not naturally see truth. Ephesians 2 does refer to us in our fallen state, unredeemed, as children of wrath. And that is speaking of being a child of Satan. And so in that sense, how does that affect it? Well, I would say it's the primary reason we don't understand truth or perceive truth without Christ's help. But then also in 2 Corinthians, we turn to Christ. That veil, that guard of truth that is on our soul, is lifted when we turn to Christ. And then the Spirit does transform and help us to understand. Those are kind of my thoughts. There's, I went in my own mind down the thought of total depravity, 1 Corinthians 2, 2 Corinthians 4. Satan does blind, but God obviously illumines. So any other thoughts on that there, guys?
I have never thought about this question, so I don't think I have anything to say. This was a totally new thought to me, so I'm going to leave it in your guys' hands.
Yeah, if you have any follow-up questions, Tim, or if there's a nuance to your question that you'd like to add in, we do have an email that you can send us questions to.
Can I give a shout-out real quick to him and his...
Yeah.
Okay, so Tim Forrester, guess what he does for a business, Charlie?
Is he a forester?
He has a tree service, I kid you not. It's Forrester Tree Care. They will go and cut down trees in neighborhoods. They're very good at it. And so I would totally give a shout out if you need a tree removed. Like, his company does amazing work. There was one tree that it had to have been 15 feet in diameter, and when they dropped it, it had like a 6-foot rotted out core in the middle. They did a really good job, but I still think it's the greatest thing ever. If your last name's Forrester and then you have a tree care business, that is like next level in my mind. So that's all, just a shout out.
So I haven't really put a lot of thought into this either. He is presenting an interesting issue question. And the key phrase is that it's like children of the devil, you know, children of Satan. So like in John 8, you are of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a lie and the father of it. And I wonder if there's like just different degrees of lostness, because who's Jesus talking to?
Pharisees?
Yeah. And so they're not like just blind. They are blind, but they are encouraging blindness. And what would Satan more actively be doing through specific individuals?
So to draw a connection to what you've talked about before, maybe a difference between like a fool and a scorner.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So this is like the scoffer, scorner, who's a child of the devil, because what are they doing? They're deceiving others.
They're propagating
the falsehood.
That's interesting too, because remember when Jesus calls Peter Satan.
Yes, exactly.
Because he's behaving like Satan.
Yes.
And so that would make a lot of sense. And so these, maybe you're saying these people are so like opposed to God that you wouldn't want to touch them with like a 20 foot pole.
There you go.
Or like a 30 foot.
Or whack them with the pole.
Or you want to whack them with, you want to whack them with a 20 foot. So I like that.
If there's a listener and you are familiar with this conversation and have a book or resource to recommend, you could send that to us as well. And we'd love to have that because this isn't something I've studied.
And so I did just change the color on you because I realized the first sentence there, you have no context to that. So Dan Wirtz sent us two emails.
Okay.
The first line there, he had sent us that a previous discussion we were having about, I can't remember exactly what passage, but I think you were studying a passage in the Old Testament with us. And so he was like, hey, that was super helpful. And he was also studying and he was, you know, he was putting his Hebrew to work, which, so I just wanted to give him a shout out. Because he was like, hey, I like this episode. And he was preparing a sermon on Psalm 136. And he was talking about clauses in Hebrew. And I was like, that deserves a shout out. That's not a question, though. So now the green stuff is the question from his second email.
And that's what I'm supposed to read right now?
Yes.
Okay. I know a divorced man would not be eligible to be trained for a full pastoral ministry. But what about trained to preach for the purpose of pulpit supply as an extension of a local church's ministry to other churches of like faith and practice while they are in transition or while a local pastor is in vacation, is on vacation. So in essence, could somebody be trained to preach like as a, on a fill-in basis? So as a pulpit supply, not necessarily pastor, but to just open the word. So the rest of the reading now, I'm going to read the rest of it. If this isn't a question, if this isn't a question for the pod, I understand. I can't draw a line in my own conviction at this moment, so I don't have a firm position yet. But I lean into training in this specific stance with an understanding that full-time pastoral ministry is not something in this man's hypothetical future, i.e. there's no applicable calling. Okay, that's a spicy question. What do you guys think?
I remember a pastor who said that the two ways a pastor leads is through his example and through his ministry of preaching the word. If that's true, and I do think you could say that preaching the word has a level of authority, which is why Paul doesn't allow women to preach the word, because he doesn't want them to have that kind of authority over men. If that's true, then you just have to ask the question, is a man who's not qualified for the office of leadership all able to be trained and qualified to do the function of the office of leadership? I don't know what I think. I mean, this is just free-flowing thoughts here. So you guys dive in.
Yeah. So I'm going to answer the question directly, and then I'm going to caveat my answer, which is what I love to
Fantastic.
Do. So do I think it's wrong to do that? No, I don't. As long as he's not a pastor, he's not a pastor. You're correct. He's not called to pastor. He should not be, he is not qualified and should not be named pastor. So is it wrong to train them to fill in? Sure. Caveats. So one, let's ask a better question. Why would we be training the man who would not be qualified for the full-time pastoral position when we could be training so many others that would be? And so why would we be planning to put a man in the position of the authority of the pulpit who we know can't be there permanently? So I'll just say that while it's not wrong, I don't even want to say it's not wise, but I'd say there's a much better option. Like if you've got one man in your church that you know is unqualified, why would we be like, oh, let's train him to preach when we're gone? Why wouldn't you be like, oh, here's three other guys that are qualified or could be called. Let's train them.
Yeah. I love that answer.
And now again, do I think it's wrong? Not at all. And, obviously, you know, one of the sticky things with divorce is it is such a personal aspect of someone's life. And so this is in no way a demeaning or a begrudging statement. Like, why would you spend your time or waste your time on that? I think everyone in our church deserves discipleship. Maybe deserves isn't the right word. We should all be discipling each other. And that would include equipping people to understand the word of God. I just think for me, there's a good, better, best. And while it might be good to have a gentleman trained to fill in preaching every now and then, but we know he's not qualified. That might be an okay or a good option, but there is certainly a better and a best option, which would be to train men who would be or could be. And then I think the best option would be to identify those that want to be and train them.
So one of the issues, just that a young, somebody who might, this individual is actually interested, whereas some of those others probably aren't. So that's probably feeding the question and the problem. So go ahead.
Well, then think about this, to play devil's advocate a little bit here. What would keep us from training people who are not divorced and then them getting divorced and they're still apt to teach? Would you want them to be preaching? And I think kind of maybe flipping does the flip of the question make sense there? Like,
yeah. So, I mean, I know one previous pastor who's divorced and he goes out and he still preaches every once in a while. And he's an individual that I respect, and it was his wife leaving him. And so this isn't something that's just like high pie up in the sky. It's not practical for me. And I'm aware of the issues connected to it. I'll be honest with you. I have not established firm convictions on it. I have hesitations. Well, and so I would probably just leave it there right now.
I think the other caveat too is this, the context of the question is we're talking about an exception, and it's an exception where we know the rule. So I don't think you would ever want to take an exceptional idea and make it a part of your standard practice. That would be taking exception and making it rule. So to say like, oh, if you're divorced, yeah, we'll have you preach. That's fine. Like making that so standard, when I think this is an exceptional part of a hypothetical.
I think he realizes yeah.
And
that
so
too.
That to me would be the, I wouldn't want to establish a pattern that sets the church up for anything less than full health in the future. I would say the same thing. So, again, not to demean or begrudge anyone, I would say the same thing about having a deacon preach regularly. That could be also potentially unhealthy for a church, putting a deacon, which is a servant, in the position of teaching authority, which is not the office they hold. Mm-hmm. Now, could you, I don't like the phrase, but could you get away with it if people are humble and kind to each other? Of course you can. But would that be a pattern putting a church in the best position for health? I would say you probably don't want to play with it. But anyway.
And I would say with the deacon question too, if the deacon is a servant and they're to assist the pastor and the pastor goes on vacation and that's their assisting, that's one thing. But if it's like, oh, I want to get this guy regularly in front of the church, let them hear his voice, but he's then exercising leadership. I mean,
spiritual influence.
Yeah. And I would just say, you want to think about, is that the role of a deacon? And if that's what the guy is doing, should he be like working toward the pastorate then,
Yeah.
It might be that somebody's moving him.
Yeah.
And there's a progression there too.
Yeah.
I would also, I just had this thought that, so I'm a widower and I've had to steward this trial God put in my life, right? And so I've talked about stewarding it and not being selfish with your suffering and whatnot. It just occurred to me that if you were to go through a divorce, even if it's your fault, you're going to have to bear that. And then you're going to have to steward that going forward.
It's a stewardship.
And if you're a divorced man and you agree that divorced men shouldn't be pastors, then perhaps it's on you to say, I'm going to try to find the best way I can serve God within his confines and start leading that way and stewarding your current life scenario so that you're a big help. You know what I'm saying? Like, do what you can. And then don't try to do things that would cause the pastor to have to sit there and weigh it out. But I'm not going to be careful. This is just on the fly, but you've got to steward that too. And you got to ask, is this biblically what God would want me to do in that scenario?
Yeah. And I'm kind of even backtracking in my own mind as I've even thought about what I've said. I just thinking, just to put another kind of blip on the radar, why is it that we have a character qualification of a pastor in the first place? And then think about it as, let's say you did have a visiting unbeliever and then someone that is not qualified to pastor is the one preaching your service. How that could be perceived from a community you know, and just, you know, not to throw another, but I just, again, trying to think through the other avenues of how that could be received. So I don't know, but all right, we're going to have a final meditation in God's word in 2 Corinthians 4 and going to go back to Tim's question, kind of, but just to read these verses. So 2 Corinthians 4, 1 through 6. Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart, but we have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word, but by an open statement of the truth, we would commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants, for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And Tim's question was about, you know, Satan's seed and the perception of truth. And there's actually some really kind of haunting news here in 2 Corinthians 4 that the adversary does want to hinder the ministry of the word. He does not want people to see the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in Christ. And how does our God, the God, how does he combat that? He produces the light in us. He shines in our hearts, according to verse 6. And as the character of God shines or radiates out from us, along with a simple proclamation of the word back in verses 3 or 2, that is how ministry takes place. It is just simply telling people what the word says and having the requisite character of Christ that founds that message. And so, while there are many that are blind and being blinded, we partake in the ministry of their sight by walking in sanctification and proclaiming the simple truth of the gospel. And so hopefully that encourages you, and thanks for listening. We like talking about you and your questions, so thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.